Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Stephanie Swallow, whose highly anticipated new novel is Should the Waters Take Us. Stephanie Swallow is the author of the critically acclaimed short story collection, Last One Out, Shut Off the Lights, published in 2020. She's originally from Lake Charles, where her new book is largely set, and she teaches in the creative writing program at the University of Chicago. Her new book, her first novel, is Should the Waters Take Us. It is one of those new books that makes critics into earnest evangelists and makes readers long to read it again for the thrill of the first time. Stephanie Swallow, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Susan, and thank you for the kind words about the book.
So true. This is a book that is big in every way, in scope, in achievement, in its refusal to accept boundaries. It's 400 years of the lives of a family, and they come from France. They make their way eventually to South Louisiana, and I want to know, when you tackle something so big, what's the original spark? Do you remember?
I do. There were several sparks that sort of all came together and finally manifested in the idea for this book. For one thing, I think the most important spark and sort of the deep personal impetus behind this book is that I was raised, as you said, in Lake Charles by my Cajun French grandparents, my extended family. We all lived in the house together. I had two aunts and an uncle and my mom, who was a single parent, and my grandparents all living in the house. And they, of course, they came from Evangeline Parish and had moved to Lake Charles after the war. And I loved them dearly. They spoke French at home. They spoke French to each other and their friends who'd come to visit. And I remember having, much like my character Jamie in this book, a presentiment that there was an end coming. You know, not only were these people I was so devoted to and dependent on elderly, you know, so there's always that end coming, but also as I started to understand more the Cajun Creole culture in Louisiana and how fragile it is, how, you know, my aunts and my mom and my uncle don't speak Cajun French, maybe a little bit. I don't have to tell Louisiana listeners that except for the Herculean efforts of like CODAFIL and people who are trying to maintain the language and the cultural aspects, it's been sort of a dying situation. And so I had a tremendous kind of grief around that. And that also attached to the house that we all grew up in, that my grandfather built. I knew that this was not, it wouldn't always be our house. It might be sort of a character flaw or virtue. I don't know, this like presentiment of loss and nostalgia. So there was that combined with, you know, you fly in over New Orleans or any place in South Louisiana and you see the raggedy wetlands, you know, you know. And if you don't know what's happening down there, you look down and you just see like, oh, that's a lot of water. And what's going on with those straight cut rivers as opposed to like the winding rivers? And why is it so watery here and a little bit of patch of land here? It looks very ragged. And as I learned why that was, which was the, you know, widespread coastal erosion, again, I don't need to educate Louisiana listeners about that. That intersected, I think, with my own personal sense of impending loss. Like, oh, not only is a culture eroding, but the land under our feet is eroding, you know? And what do you do when your sense of home is always overlaid with this knowledge or dread that it won't be there forever.
And what hurricanes do you remember growing up?
I left for college in 1994, and so I missed a fair number of them, although I was often on the phone with my mom or
I'm curious though, because a lot of times after Hurricane Katrina, for example, a lot of Louisianans who were away were involuntarily cast in the role of speaker, expert.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember my daughter was in grad school and all of a sudden she was talking about New Orleans in ways, you know, she was answering new questions about her hometown. And I wonder if that happened to you as well.
I think it definitely did. And I was far away when that happened. And likewise, when the oil spill was happening. And also when Hurricane Laura hit Lake Charles in 20, was that 2020? And watching that from a distance is very hard. And likewise, knowing that you aren't really there on the ground suffering with everyone, you're just heart sick for them and for this place that you love or have complicated feelings about. I think I was often called upon to answer. I mean, the question that often came up, or like the snide remark that often came up, was something you see, you know, often enough in like the New York Times comments on anything about Louisiana land loss. Well, why are they staying there? You know, like they're courting their own doom. And you stay there because you love the place and your history is written on the landscape and as much as that landscape can hold it. So I did feel like I was sort of an ambassador in that way. But I was also kind of stunned to frequently enough have conversations about, you know, after Katrina, not even that long after Katrina, and after the Deepwater Horizon, where I would bring it up because I was working on it or because like it was on my mind, you know. Often enough, the person I was talking to would have forgotten that it happened and, you know, oh, just wiped off their, you know, like it fell down below the fold in the newspaper and that was that, you know. I think I felt also compelled to keep it at the forefront of others' imaginations. You know, these problems are not, I mean, they are local to Louisiana, but I think the loss of home, especially in this era of migration and climate change, and it's a common feeling that our connection to home is tenuous. It's not just regional.
So tell us about the Terrebonnes and the Thibodeaux and the Broussards, these families you've chosen to write about.
Yeah, so one of the protagonists of the novel is Boy Broussard. He sort of makes a living catch as catch can off the land. He doesn't own the land. He's been hunting and trapping and fishing on his uncle's property while his uncle has sort of turned a blind eye. But they're now coming into conflict as the uncle, Jacko Terrebonne, is more aware of his, you know, he's aging, he's got a grandson to look after. The situation with respect to erosion on his land has made it such that, you know, the oil royalties that he had been bringing in are now being partly apportioned to the state and the land is disappearing. So he's looking at selling. So they come into conflict over this particular little patch of land, which has been in one family or another since the Spanish land grant that allotted it to their forebear. Those are the two families who are in conflict.
There's so much sadness in this one family. Death, suicide. I mean, just so much loss. It's a lot. I mean, for so talk about writing that and going into that big picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm naturally a melancholy person, and the art and literature and film that I love, I like being upset. You know, it's just a funny thing to say, but I'm writing toward my own aesthetic in that way, and it's not everyone's cup of tea. I was having a conversation with my 13-year-old yesterday who is just discovering Wes Anderson films. And so and I like Wes Anderson fine. I don't particularly connect with Wes Anderson films. And they were, you know, my kid was asking me why, and I was like, I don't know. It's sort of twee. It doesn't really cut me. And they said, why does something have to hurt you for you to love it? You know? So
Whoa.
I think that I know. Okay, so the child sees me, but I think I am drawn to the kinds of stories that like that take on grief full in the face. I think it's sort of a way of practicing the grief or girding yourself against the grief. So, I mean, that's my own aesthetic. But
what's inevitable? I mean, it's big businesses overrunning Louisiana. I mean, you know, it's just, we know this.
But I hope that counterbalancing that is Boy's insouciance and sense of humor. You know, he'll be fine ish. You know, he'll still drink his beer in the afternoon. I hope that the book ends on a more hopeful note than all of the grieving that leads up to it would expect.
There's a lot of joie de vivre in this book, too. They're really
good. Oh, good.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephanie Swallow, whose new novel is Should the Waters Take Us. This is such a story of spiritual struggle as well, which I find so moving. And one of the characters who is just so lovable and such a moral conscience in the book is Father Fabian. So tell us a bit about him inventing that character. I love him. I mean,
I'm so glad. I love him too. And in some ways, he's the character who most reflects maybe my own sense of faith and mind. But he is originally from Nigeria, grew up in the Niger Delta in a village that and was surrounded by oil development and, you know, the pollution and problems that come of the oil development. So he's very deeply aware of what it means to be beset by this industry. He came to Louisiana as a parish priest 5 or 6 years before we meet him in the present. So he went through Katrina in his first months there. And he became a priest. I think I'd describe it as, you know, he signed up for the priesthood as some boys do for the military, right? That was his, it was a way to be something and to see more of the world than he originally expected to. So his faith is wobbly. He's smart. He's got a wisdom he also carries around his own despair and feelings of guilt for having left his home, which is struggling, you know, as much and worse. And he loses patience with people, and he sees himself losing patience with Boy, for example, and is, because of his own compromised faith, has a hard time, I think, comforting the people around him. And he's also, this is set, it's a fictional parish. It's, I call it Pellerin Parish, but I was very much inspired by Lafourche Parish. And he's one of the few, you know, Black faces down there. And so he's very conspicuous. He's also a priest, so he gets respect. But he, I think, holds himself apart as much as he is held apart by his parishioners. I think he's suffering from that sense of a divide between himself and the people he's serving.
So read a little bit about him from the book that is so wonderful.
Sure. So I'll read this bit that you recommended, where he's reflecting on the months after Katrina, when Jaco Terrebonne's son, who was a fisherman, came to him seeking guidance. Not long after that storm, a fisherman, no more than 40 years old, came to him in crisis. A sweet man, quiet-spoken, polite, but not only polite. The sort of man who would ask after your health, your day, your work, and then listen, genuinely, to the answer. He would have made a wonderful priest. He took communion in the old-fashioned way, like his elderly father and mother, who were always in line before him, with an open mouth, and when Fabian placed the wafer on his tongue, their eyes met, the man imploring and Fabian bestowing, a father feeding his child. What good was that moment of grace, though, when the man came to him, laid his despair at Fabian's feet? What had Fabian managed to give? The source of the despair? Katrina, of course, the boat he lost, swept away by the storm surge. A woman he found floating in the marsh, drowned in the days after. His unhappy wife, eager to leave the state altogether. His young son, strange and shy and so much like himself, it frightened him. The weight of the past, the weight of the future, every year another hurricane season. How does anyone keep going in the face of perennial disaster? What sensible person can hold on to faith when storms or oil or war or famine destroys his world again and again? Most men are not Job, content to scratch their boils on the ash heap of their former homes and praise God for their own spared lives. We all feel such dread, Fabian said to the man, but we must go on living even so. Why must we? The man replied. Whatever answer Fabian gave about testing faith, accepting both good and adversity as gifts from God, was no answer at all, and within a month he was saying the man's funeral mass. To reject this life is perhaps the most sensible reply to the miseries that have tormented every living creature on this planet since creatures began to live. Miseries often inflicted upon the living by the living, a 25-foot storm surge plowing through insufficiently maintained levees, drowning a city, the blessing of oil, the curse of oil, wealth that saves and wealth that destroys. Later today, after the blessing of the fleet, he will deliver communion to that man's dying mother. He'd known her from the first day of his arrival here, one of a few old women who would have him over to their homes for supper, and he liked her very much because she always took both his hands in hers and kissed his cheeks, called him Shah, even after he failed her son. She asked about Nigeria. She knew about his sister, his nephews. When the time comes to eulogize her, he will have things to say. He doesn't always.
And that is the question. Why do we go on? Why do we go on here? So now you've said in writing this book, you practically had to give yourself a PhD in land law, ecology, history, the whole nine yards. So talk about that research. What would a trip to Louisiana be like for you? What would you do and look for?
Well, I think that when I first started fumbling toward the story, I went down it, I think it was 6 months or so after Katrina, and I had been thinking about wanting to write a book about that area before Katrina happened. And so here was this terrible storm, you know? And I lined up a bunch of interviews, including with one of the most important ones was with the writer Wendy Wilson Billiott. I don't know if she's come across your desk at all, but she lives down in Bayou du Large, and she was a very warm and welcoming presence, invited me into her home, let me stay in the FEMA trailer out back and rounded up several people for me to talk to, including some friends of hers who were indigenous Houma, much of her family was. And so I remember sitting with one of her friends at her kitchen table, and he had laid out maps of the surrounding area and could, point his finger to any place on the map, and like he was playing pin the tail on the donkey, and unfurl a story about that particular little corner of the map. I remember his intonation, when he was talking about the oil companies who, they took me on boat rides too through the marsh, and you ride through the marsh, and there's signs for Apache oil and gas everywhere, or whatever, whoever is leasing the mineral rights for whatever patch of land. And I remember him saying, and this used to be ours, and then the oil companies came in and stole the land. And he leaned into my microphone and said, "Stole the land," like that, and like that stuck with me. And I was like, "Ooh, okay, I want to find out more about that." And so that led into a lot of research into, property rights and how mineral rights work and what happens when there is environmental damage, who is responsible for it. And I talked to lawyers who told me about mitigation and read oral histories about, including about, some circumstances in which people had been bilked of their land, unknowingly because they had signed a quitclaim deed, and didn't realize that they were signing away the rights to their land. They couldn't read, So in compiling all of these stories, and every piece of research led to more, like it was just, oh God, this is why it took me 20 years to write the book, because I was trying very hard to get it right. And even so, I'm sure I've gotten a thousand things wrong. But then I was wondering about, okay, how do the indigenous communities relate to the oil industry as opposed to the white Cajun communities, or it was, yes, it was a quite a rabbit hole.
And you bring that sinister character, the landman, to
The
life.
landman. Yeah. Oh, the little ad that Jacko has tacked on his office wall. I mean, I wrote that one, but it was based on something that I had actually seen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephanie Swallow, whose new novel is Should the Waters Take Us. There was one other passage that just struck with me. So it was that passage where the rig comes apart. And so here's this oil rig just falling apart in the Gulf. And it was horrific. I mean, I couldn't turn the pages fast enough, but I could, you know what I mean? At the same time, I didn't want to know. And that must have been really hard to write.
It was, and I was very mindful that I was, representing people's lived experience. And again, I wanted to get it right. And I certainly don't want to capitalize on it, but you can't ignore that it happened. And so I was listening to interviews with survivors of the Deepwater Horizon spill. And I fictionalized mine so I could play a little fast and loose with the numbers, I guess. And I certainly didn't, and I didn't want to claim anyone else's story as mine. But I'd listened to the stories from survivors. I was reading Black Tide by Antonia Juhasz, was a book that I was leaning on a lot. And she's got, she had sort of these collected interviews with people who had been on the rig. And yeah, it was harrowing to read it, firsthand accounts of that experience. And it must have been absolutely terrifying. And then the idea that you were sitting on the boat while it was still burning, knowing that your friends and comrades, some had been left on that burning platform, is horrifying.
I'm curious how you feel about this book now that you're finished with it. Do you feel like this was your book to write, that this was the book that would draw on all your strengths and
I
concerns?
think so. I struggled with it for such a long time. And at one point it was something like 600 pages. And then my beautiful editor was like, "You don't need that. You don't need that." And we slimmed it down quite a bit. And I think ultimately, yeah, I look at this book and I feel very proud. And I think this is the book that I set out to write, even though it took a lot of struggling to, and trying to find a voice and also trying to come at the material from as many angles as was possible. Because I understand too that it's not a good guy, bad guy kind of situation. It's a lot of like people making the best choices they can in the moment for themselves and their loved ones. And sometimes those choices accrue into something that isn't ultimately the best for themselves and their loved ones or their community. So I wanted to make sure that the book was asking more questions than it was answering. And I think in that respect, yes, this is the book I meant to write. And I hope it is doing that. I hope it doesn't come off as a screed.
Well, you've made something really beautiful. We've been talking with Stephanie Swallow, whose new novel is Should the Waters Take Us. You can meet her Monday, July 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Stephanie, thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Kirsten Casey signs The Hands That Treat Friday, July 10th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Karen Essex, an award-winning novelist, journalist, and screenwriter, will discuss her life as a screenwriter at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, July 11th at the Wagner Library in Metairie. Essex is the author of the national and international best-selling novel Leonardo's Swans, about the muses of Leonardo da Vinci, Stealing Athena, the story of the controversial Elgin Marbles, and Dracula in Love, a retelling of the original vampire tale. Mixologist Elizabeth Pierce will discuss a classic cocktail, the Sidecar, and Chef Nora Wetzel will focus on an easy recipe for chocolate mousse at two food demonstrations at two different libraries, one on each bank of the river. These events occur at the following dates and times: 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, July 14th, West Bank Regional Library, 2751 Manhattan Boulevard in Harvey, 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, July 15th, East Bank Regional Library, 4747 West Napoleon Metairie. This is free of charge and open to the public. Patrons younger than 21 years of age will not be served alcohol. Ocean Vuong appears in conversation with E.M. Tran to discuss The Ocean of Gladness, new in paperback, Thursday, July 16th at 6 p.m. at Dillard University. Sponsored by Baldwin & Company, this is a ticketed event. Tickets at Eventbrite. Stephanie Swallow discusses and signs Should the Waters Take Us, Monday, July 20th at 6 p.m. at the Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. The East Bank Regional Library and Metairie will hold a warehouse and puzzle sale Saturday, July 25th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. or until sold out. Proceeds benefit the Jefferson Parish Library System. The East Bank Regional Library and Metairie will hold a warehouse and puzzle sale Saturday, July 25th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. or until sold out. Proceeds benefit the Jefferson Parish Library System. This sale will feature boxes of CDs, DVDs, children's books, cookbooks, romance, and regular fiction, paperback and hardback. No checks.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.